I looked at my friends who went to Harvard and went to Yale, and I looked at them like they're better than me. That was the craziest thing. I really judge myself because I went to a second tier university, as if like, oh, but they got into one of the Ivy.
Didn't you like keep your rejection letter from Columbia or something like that?
Thank you for bringing that up. I actually have it framed next to my nightstand.
You're welcome.
And now I wrote a book. So if you're listening in Columbia, suck it. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Everything That Rises, the podcast about the short stories of the one and only Miss Flannery O'Connor. My name is John Meehan. I'm an English teacher, an author, a speaker, presenter here based out of Arlington, Virginia, greater Washington, D.C. area. And each week I bring in people who are from all over the place to talk about this stuff. And I've met them from my travels as an English teacher, as a speaker, as a Catholic. And I like people who are like way smarter about this stuff to come in and show me what this is all about. So, without any further ado, I want to reintroduce this week a great friend of mine who I've known for like 20 years, which just makes me feel very old. You want to say hi to everybody?
Hi, everybody. My name is Mike Tenney. I am a Catholic high school theology teacher. And when I'm not doing that, I am a speaker at various Catholic events, mostly for youth. And I lead worship. I also blog for a couple different Catholic sites, the Holy Ruckus and the Grotto Network out of Notre Dame.
Baller. And you have a fancy couple letters after your name as a degree goes for the master's level. Yeah.
Yes. So I have an undergraduate degree in English and secondary education, then a master's degree in theology.
What we're saying is you're not just making it up. I mean, maybe.
No. I might make some stuff up. You never know.
I was talking to my students today on a Zoom call, and I said, you know, we were talking about another Flannery O'Connor short story because at this time of the year, I love reading her fiction. It's great. It's a great thing because they're bite-sized. They're small. They're like meditations.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I do wonder if you deal with people who you think are smarter than you, do you find yourself scared of them because you don't think like you can get away with stuff? But if you deal with people who you think are lower than you or less educated than you, do you feel like you can just kind of pull one over on them? And I said, maybe that's why I still teach high school, because you're all their kids. And so I could just like make stuff up and be like, no, that's what the author meant. Like, I don't know. As a Catholic school teacher, do you have the opportunity to talk about the lived experience of faith with your students that goes outside of like just book learning? If that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I always, that's where I try to live is like, and I say this to my students all the time, like, especially whenever we're taking a test, I say, the real test is not what you do in this class. The real test is how you walk out this door and treat one another and have a relationship with God and yourself. And that's the real test. And that's what we're really here for. Like, I would much rather you fail this class academically and then go out and actually live the gospel, than ace this class and then, you know, go out and never think about God again and never think about your fellow human beings again. And, so absolutely, it's all about the lived experience.
That's awesome, man. That's a really powerful way to say it. I wonder if you can put that on the report cards. Okay, so you failed this class, but you passed it.
You are a great person and Jesus loves you.
You troublemaker. Oh my. Let's do this. So we're recapping a story, picking up. If you did not have a chance to listen to last week's podcast, and shame on you, it's available in the archives. We took about the first half of the story, Greenleaf, by Flannery O'Connor. And Mike, you had a chance to kind of give us the episode kind of preview last time. Can you do like a previously on Greenleaf to catch everybody up to speed about where we were?
Yeah. So previous on Greenleaf, we met Mrs. May, who fancies herself to be a high society Southern woman, but has moved out to a dairy farm. Her husband died. She lives with her two sons who don't seem to like each other or her. She employs the Greenleafs. Well, Mr. Greenleaf, who's kind of a down to earth country folk, you know, not too smart, but he and his wife is like super like fundamentalist, maybe a little bit crazy town religious, and but seem to be really good people. And their two sons are like war heroes, Purple Heart winners, and have done really well for themselves, married French women, and are raising children. And they're doing the Greenleaves in a lot of ways are doing way better than the Mays, even though Mrs. May employs Mrs. Greenleaf. And the Greenleafs seem to be like a much more functional family, and they get along better, and they seem to be on the up and up, whereas the Mays seem to be at the top and going down. So
yeah, and at the very minimal amount of external conflict that the story has, because it's really a lot of backstory over 30 pages, right?
Yeah, and basically the story is a bull escaped on this dairy farm, and Mrs. May is upset about it, and she wants Mr. Greenleaf to do something about it. And yep. Mr. Greenleaf is kind of like, well, somebody's got to do something about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm from New Jersey, and you're from the old line state, Maryland, right?
Maryland, yeah.
But it's different down here, and I quietly hate it every day, because it's just so much slower, it's so much kinder, it's so much nicer. You get south of the Mason-Dixon line and everything changes. The North is so hustle bustle. The North is so anxiety ridden. It's all agita. It's go, 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 go. Mm-hmm. And my mom and I, my dad, my mom, and my brothers and I, we did a trip down to Florida when I was a teenager. And we're driving down to I-95 and we stopped at one of these podunk roadside stands in Georgia or South Carolina, somewhere that was on the losing end of the Confederacy, mm-hmm. And, we pulled in, and the soda machine, for the fountain drinks, for a 7-Eleven or whatnot, wasn't dispensing anything. So my mom was angry, because my mom is very northern, very fast paced. And so she's like, we gotta get back in the car, let's go. She walks up to the counter and says to the clerk, she's like, your soda machine's down. Clerk stops, pauses, he might as well be chewing tobacco, looks real slow to the left, looks at the machine, still standing behind the counter, doesn't move, looks at it for 2-3 seconds, turns back to my mom and says, yup.
total Mr. Greenleaf mood. That's a right? Total Mr. Greenleaf mood. Yeah.
Oh man, that drives me nuts. The idea that the South is just so, something's got to be done about it. So do something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's my northern anxiety.
Well, and Maryland isn't even at least the part of Maryland I'm from isn't even real South. There are some parts of Maryland that are real South, but the parts that you've lived
you have a tobacco leaf and your flag is a NASCAR flag, right? Isn't that the it's like NASCAR meets Jesus.
NASCAR meets Jesus, exactly. It's a great flag. We love our flag, man. It's better than any other state flag.
No, it's...
I saw somebody post a meme the other day that was nobody, and then it says Maryland, and it's a guy wearing an entire suit of the Maryland flag. I'm like, yep, that's us. We love our flag.
NASCAR meets Jesus. I think you told me that in college, and I was like, all right, here we go.
Yeah.
So here we go. So we're in the South, and things are just slower now, and Mr. Greenleaf is super South.
You know, it's interesting. Somebody, So I was in Georgia leading a retreat a few months ago, and it was with a priest that you and I both knew in college, and he was in Connecticut before this, and now he's in Georgia. And I said, people are so friendly down here. He's like, they are friendly, but you wouldn't believe how much behind the back, there's not. You know, sometimes there's some nastiness behind your back. And he's like, and up in Connecticut, in New England, everybody's got a rough exterior, but once they're your people, they're ride or die.
I get it, man.
You know, and they'll tell you to go F yourself, but really they're down till the end, you know? So it was kind of interesting to hear his
you perspective. You and I have had this conversation, this is not about Flannery O'Connor, but just about life, about the four types of people that I've had this taxonomy, right? We've had this conversation.
yeah.
And I'm sure, now I know why you asked me beforehand when we got on the podcast, can we cuss on this podcast? I was like, maybe. I'm going to use the word jerk instead of the word I'm thinking of that is maybe more nasty.
Yeah.
There's four types of people, I think. There's the people who are jerks on the outside, but are really nice on the inside.
That's you.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. While I slag on all my Southern listeners, both of them, I have my mom's one listener, so I guess I have three listeners on this podcast. They're jerks on the outside. That's a very Connecticut thing. That's a very New York thing, a very Jersey thing. They're just they're unrepentant bad guys, or so it looks like. But you get to know them, and it's they'll give the shirt off their back. They'll bend over backwards for you. They're really, deep down, they're ride or die with you. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you have the people who are nice on the outside. Oh, bless their hearts. Yeah, what can you do? Mm-hmm. But then if you get to the inside, that's where the jerk is. And I don't mean to oversimplify, but that feels like a lot of the Southern propriety and old mannered South of the aristocracy and the gentry, that feels like something that Flannery O'Connor is taking shots at here.
Yeah. Like, it feels like Mrs. May in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Who like says has no time for religion herself, but is upset when people say bad things about religion.
Yeah.
And then you have those other two, you know, I guess variables, if it's a Punnett square, who you have people who are just nice people on the outside who are also nice people on the inside. And maybe that's where the Greenleaf family is. Like, they're actually pretty homogenous. They have their lives, you know, simple, like the lilies of the field. Or you have the people who are mean on the outside and mean on the inside, like the jerks. And I think that that might be where Schofield and Wesley find themselves.
I was just going to say that, Schofield and Wesley. They're jerk jerks.
I mean, like, the jerk nice or the jerk
I think that's
jerks,
absolutely accurate. Yeah. Yeah.
Because here we are. We're the second half of the story, and this bull has gone amissing. And so we find ourselves now on the farm of the Greenleafs, and it's up to Mrs. Greenleaf to, like, get it taken care of, because no one's taking care of anything. And in our last podcast, you were talking about, like, as she shows up at the Greenleafs, I guess not the farm, but, like, the tenant houses or something like that. Like, I guess it is – it's a growing farm. You noticed that – it bothered you the way it was kind of set up or laid out here.
Well, it bothered her that she gets to OT and ET, those are the Greenleaf sons. She gets to their houses and she's like really surprised at like how nice it is. And the children don't look as slovenly as she thought they were going to look. And they don't look Greenleafish enough. They had on overalls and were barefooted, but they were not as dirty as she might have expected. There were two or three that looked distinctly like green leaves. The others, not much so. It's like you're describing, like, most of them don't look like green leaves. Maybe that's not
a great
what green
point,
leaves
because
look like.
Because if four or five look a different way, then that's the exception. That is the rule, right?
And the other thing is, she like count the number of times in the car. Like, once she's in the car, pretty much all she does is honk.
Yep.
She just honks at everybody. She shows up outside and she's honking at them and they're all just staring at her. And she's like, why are you just staring? And I was like, somebody drove up to my house and just started honking. I'd be staring too. But she just honks so much. Like anytime. And so like, she's really the rude one, you know, she thinks she's so proper or whatever, but really she's like super, super rude.
I'm interested here too, and maybe this is overstretching, but like good literature allows you to step into it again and again and again. It feels like in a time of COVID, she would be a person who feels frustrated that she's had to be sequestered or quarantined on her farm because she has to get her hair done. And so she wants to like get in her car and honk at like the people who are crossing the street, including people like your wife who are like, you know, like working in the front lines of hospitals to make sure that people stay alive and stuff. And she's like, oh, you're in my way. I have to get my hair done.
She would have an excuse for like everything that she does out of line, but be totally indignant that anybody else had anything to do, you know?
So, I mean, she finds herself at the Greenleaf's farm and she mentions that the kids all kind of, you know, say nothing or like don't want to talk at once. And she says, like, if there are six of them, she says, the line about the cat, she's like, the cat has six tongues or something like that. All of them are just kind of looking her, eyeing her up, like a true Greenleaf trait, they said. And I think that idea of the six tongues is a clue, because there's a few times in the story where we get sixes that come up. She honks the horn in the car towards the back end six times. There are six Greenleaf kids.
They stopped about 6 feet from the automobile.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not one into numerology, but like that 666 come up again and again and again. I start to think about like issues of heaven and hell and things about like good people and bad people. Because as she's opening her mouth, she says she laughed and her laugh died on the silent air. She felt as if she were on trial for her life. Like all of these Greenleaf kids are just looking at her like, I don't think your jokes are funny, lady. I don't think that this is, you know, like that to me is another sign that like we've now crossed the point of no return when she kind of goes to their farm.
Yeah, well, and it also reminded me of, I don't know if in your neighborhood, but my neighborhood growing up, there was always like the one house with the cranky lady or the cranky guy. I remember one time playing on the wrong neighbor's yard and the old man comes out, get the hell off of my lawn. I gotta imagine that like she's got a reputation, you know, she's been hassling their grandfather for 15 years. Like in the Greenleaf family, Mrs. May has a reputation as like this nasty old woman. And she shows up at their house and starts honking, being like, where is your father? And they're all just like, you know, and she's,
Which is interesting though, because like, she's like the cranky old lady, yet she sees herself in her version of it as like the nice one who took care of them, who, like, you know, when your dads were kids, that they hunted with my kids' old guns, they fished in our pond, like all that stuff. Like, look at all the stuff I used to do that was so nice for you. It's like, yeah, but what have you done for me lately? Like, that's 30 years ago, right? Like, there's something about this lady that feels curmudgeonly and out of touch and bitter. And so she's here, and it says, like, this farm is actually not just the kids who are surprisingly clean and pulled together. She says the farm had been built according to the latest specifications. The milk ran in pipes from the machines to the milk house. And it was never carried in no bucket, Mr. Greenleaf said, by no human hand. When are you going to get one? Well, like, she has.
Yeah, well, and she says, I can't do it because I don't have the government paying me like the government's paying your sons. And he's like, oh, no, my son's built this. But then he says, but all boys ain't alike. My boys have done this. But it, like, kind of a snide shot that, like, you know, my boys built this. Like, they're working hard. They're upgrading the place. Like, what are your boys doing?
And I think that's interesting because, like, you went to college. I went to college. We both went to, as one of the Greenleaf boys would call it, a second tier college, damn college, blah, blah, blah. But I looked at my friends who went to Harvard and went to Yale, and I look at them like they're better than me. That was the craziest thing. I really judge myself because I went to a second tier university, as if, like, oh, but they got into one of the Ivy.
Didn't you, like, keep your rejection letter from Columbia or something like that?
Thank you for bringing that up. I actually have it framed next to my nightstand. I have. And now I wrote a book. So if you're living in Columbia, suck it. but if we're looking at it, like, I looked at people who went to the Ivies and I was like, they're so much better than me. Oh my God, I can't compete. But then part of that turns around and says, those kids in your high school who went to the Votech schools, if you're thinking that you are less than the kids who went to the Ivies, immediately the next logical step is, but those kids who didn't go to the school like I went to, .. Is that, I mean, like, is that overstated? Is that just me? Am I on?
No, I think absolutely. She's everything's about class for her. It's all about class.
And there's a judgment there. And unfortunately, it's like, it's kind of hard coded into your DNA is if you start ranking and rating yourself against I'm better than people, then that invariably means you are also worse than people. And that's a pretty dark place to take it here, because when she says, like, you know, well, I don't rely on a government handout. He's like, hey, my kids made that, but, you know, all boys ain't alike. No, indeed. She says, thank God for that. She says that, but she doesn't believe in God.
And also just a few paragraphs before, when she's having a fight with her boys, she actually admits that she wishes OT and ET were like her sons. She kind of admits that, she's like crying and admits that, like, they were, that they're better, you know, that they had done better. So it's kind of this sad moment of clarity for her.
And I think that moment of grace is important because Flannery O'Connor often says in her stories, characters are often, like, most of her stories, she says, are about a moment of grace that is refused. Like, this woman had a chance. She said earlier, I will die when I'm good and ready. Well, major spoiler, you gon' die. You might not be good, so get ready. And there's that line in A Good Man is Hard to Find, you know, with the misfit who ultimately kills a grandmother-like character and says at the end of it, she would have been a good woman if there were someone to shoot her every minute of her life. Like, if you live life, I mean, it's a very country music thing, you live like you were dying, like, then how much different is, by the way, Tim McGraw is married to Faith Hill, or was?
I guess, I think so.
But
I
like, they still are. Maybe they aren't anymore. It's country music. I don't really care. But like, McGraw Hill is also a publishing company. Like, it has nothing to do with Tim McGraw and Faith Hill. But I'm just, that's what I do in my free time. Because I'm secretly not reading any of those books. I'm like, no, it's written in country. I refuse. But that's.
Or maybe they have a secret publishing empire. Just nobody's ever put it together. We broke the story.
This is the
here.
Illuminati of everything. You heard it here first, folks. Oh my God.
You broke the story, John Meehan. Congratulations.
Take that, Columbia. Let's go. Meanwhile, there's some guy in, like, an office in Columbia who just happened to talk across his podcast. Let me see. He's listening. He's like, I'm really glad we rejected that asshole. Okay, back to the story. So she's going through their barn and she's sizing up everything. She notices in their barn, they had a forage harvester and a rotary hay baler. Period. She had those too. Period. just keeping score, like, you know, in case anyone's noticing.
Always keeping score.
Oh man. But what's interesting is when she goes outside, some symbolism here, like, she says the light outside was not so bright, but she was conscious that the sun was directly on top of her head, like a silver bullet ready to drop into her brain. Mike Tenney, come on. Like,
I know. Well, and that was the sunlight is really interesting. Like it always references like where the sunlight is and what it's doing. And she has a dream the second night. So the story starts with the dream about the bull, but then the second night she wakes up and she was having a dream about like the sun, like breaking through the tree line, like coming after her, like charging towards her. So, a lot of foreshadowing in the dreams.
Yeah. And the idea of like, let's push some religious imagery here. Like being blinded by, wait for it, the sun,
the light,
like the light, the Jesus stuff. Like it's there. Cause she says, we're like Jesus, and Mr. Greenleaf says, she goes, I thank God for that. And my kids aren't like your kids. He's like, I thank God for everything. Like, dude, that strips you
and
bare.
It does.
Like, that's in some ways really disarming and really beautiful. So because she's so bitter, she says, I'm going to let their daddy shoot that bull first thing in the morning. She, writes a note, leaves it for, OT and ET to come in. And, she's so confused about which one is which. She's like, because she wants some dirt on this family, since she's already made it to their homestead, she's just like, by the way, who's the boss around here? Is it OT or ET? Mm-hmm. And like the servant on the farm, I guess, like she says, the Negro, she calls him. She says she had always expected that they fought between themselves secretly. The Negro, the boy, says they never quarrels. They're like one man in two skins. Mm-hmm. What do you make of this idea of that OT and ET are indistinguishable and never fighting, which is very, very different than the home that she's about to return home to?
Yeah, well, and the idea, well, and then she says back to the guy when he says that they never quarrel. She's like, well, maybe they don't just quarrel. Maybe they just don't quarrel in front of other people. Like she can't get it past her sons fight so much. She can't get it out of her head that they must fight. They must. And she really wants to, like that you were saying before, like you really. She wants to like get one over on them. Like the only time in the story you really see her happy is when she's driving with Mr. Greenleaf in the truck to shoot the bull. Mm-hmm. And she's like gleeful that she's going to make him shoot his son's bull. And that's like makes her happy. And she can tell that she's upset. It's just like, anyway, it's twisted that it like harmony in the Greenleaf family between OT and ET really disturbs her.
Yeah.
But the fact of like sowing discord in their family like makes her really happy. It's like so twisted.
I'm interested in this too about discord, because even when the boy, like the black kid on the farm, doesn't know that he'll necessarily remember her message. He's like, I'll remember it unless I forget it. Which is actually a great line. Like, I'll try and write it down. But like, I remember it if I don't forget it, he says with a touch of sullenness. She writes it down like, okay, this dumb idiot. Fine. Oh, and by the way, who's your boss and what does he do? And she's like, she's ready to throw out the baby with the bathwater and dismiss that kid, that guy, as an idiot. But then to prove that no one's as stupid as you think they're stupid, like everybody in your life has something to teach you. Everything has something to show you. The boy looks at her sullenly, then with a gleam of recognition. Hey. Is you my policy man's mother? Like he recognizes her. That's huge because she blows him off. I don't know who your policy man is. She says sharply. And like, she's out the door. The first person in her life who's ever recognized that her kids have accomplished anything is wait for it, a poor black guy. And I can't have that. It's a bad look on me.
Yeah.
So she's out.
Which
reveals a lot about race. I mean, we realize about that entitlement that comes from this idea of
and she's embarrassed of what her son does because he like sells insurance to black people, not to white people. It was interesting. I looked up insurance, like life. I was assuming it was life insurance, and it is, but so apparently there was entire life insurance companies dedicated to selling insurance policies to black people because they're they tended at the time to be lower income, and also their life expectancy and health was not as good.
Right.
So like a lot of the big insurance companies wouldn't sell to them.
Sure.
And so there was kind of a niche market, and that's what her son, it's a Schofield, right? Schofield's the business one.
Schofield's the one who's in business.
Yeah. So he's the one, and he's like makes great money at it. So, but she's like so embarrassed. She won't even be, she won't even admit that that's her son.
I think it's interesting too, because I think about, like, you know, in COVID, right? Like how communities of color are being affected by this awful pandemic, and how access to healthcare is still, now this is 60 years after the story is written, still very much affected by your neighborhood that you come from determines how much access to healthcare you have, or how much access to, like, premium, you know, protection or insurance looks like. And there is something predatory about being like an ambulance chaser type attorney who takes advantage of people who have no other alternatives save but to buy from, like, the side of a bus ad. I'm thinking, like, you know, Saul Goodman, like, you know, he's not a high end lawyer. He's like a ripoff lawyer, you know, he's a slip and fall kind of guy. And it's, seems like there's something sketchy and slimy about that, which, again, to push to Flannery O'Connor, and I'm not, again, I'm, except for Columbia University, everybody here is welcome to this podcast, but Columbia University, you're dead to me. But like,
Los Muertos.
like the folks who, I'm losing my train of thought because I'm slagging on Columbia, but, like, you know, if you are in a space where you're offering a service to people, God bless it. It's honest work, right? I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with it.
Yeah.
But the challenge here that presents is Flannery O'Connor herself is sort of judging that she's not upset that someone has to make a living. She's judging the fact that the kid happens to be named Schofield and the other kid happens to be named Wesley, because the judgment that she's making is there's something about this, I guess, fundamental approach to Christianity, which is do as I say, but not as I do. Again, like the nice on the outside, but a real jerk on the inside. And I feel like that's an indictment that Flannery O'Connor herself is kind of carrying in this Vatican I Catholic look at the world in which the story is set. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I think she's very hard on people that are, I wouldn't say hard, maybe scathing is a better word. She doesn't hold any punches for people that are kind of, that are hypocrites, you know?
Yeah.
And that are fake, I think.
And I think that's it. Like, we talk about people who are nice on the outside, but jerks on the inside. Like, she'd rather you be a little bit more brusque, but then, like, have a heart of gold.
But at the same time, she's not without sympathy for them, and she does show their humanity. I think I've heard you say before that, you know, there are no totally good characters or totally bad characters. And, you know, so even though it is very scathing towards people like Mrs. May, yet there is some, like, compassion, and, like, you do see her humanity.
Well, and we're going to find out. We're going to see more than humanity. We're going to see her guts and where her heart is in a moment. how's that for a transition? So we build back to home. She goes home and she's sad. She's angry, frustrated. Did you notice that when the kids are trying to mess with her, when they teased her, they spoke Greenleaf English. But Wesley made his own particular tone come through like a knife edge. Well, I'm going to tell you one thing, brother. If you had half mine, you know what? What's that, brother? That is that neither you, me is her boy. Really trying to put the knife between this idea of family unity, which we saw from the Greenleafs, they all blend together. Can't tell which one is which. They all speak the same language. No one ever saw them fought. And then the May family, where they lean in and they said that there's an ugly family resemblance that shows between them. One leans into the other and says, you know, like in the most snarling, nasty voice, his pleasantness disappears. He says, nobody feels sorry for a lousy bastard like you. They're barely even related. And this home has no, I mean, like, I don't know. I guess in the 20th century, and again, maybe you can kind of help me ground this. I feel that the world of Flannery O'Connor's authorship is like Vatican I leading into Vatican II, like new reforms, new openings of the church, and new, you know, ecumenical conversations with people of different faiths. But in the 2020s, it seems like religion itself is in some ways like a taboo, like a word not to be spoken outside of churches. And what she's kind of pointing out here is this household has no religion in it. And it seems like absent religion, it lacks a moral center. And I'm not trying to say that everybody has to have religion in their house to have a moral center. But I think that that's the line that she is drawing here. Like, if you don't have Jesus in your house, okay, we can make fun of those idiot rednecks, but they have Jesus and they have love and they have unity. Here, we got families who have no respect for one another. There's no unifying principle other than that they're just the rottenness is the only resemblance they have.
Yeah, you know, I didn't pick up on that, and I feel like Flannery O'Connor very often is, you know, because she does harp on, I think, religious hypocrisy, especially. I think, you know, we see that because that there's so much focus on appearances in their family, that inside, like inside the house, it's interesting, all of the discord happens inside the house, like at, physically inside the house.
Yeah.
And the boys are still living in the house, even though they don't get along, whereas the Greenleaf boys have moved out.
And are in fact not in the story. Like they exist outside of the world of even the paragraphs, right?
Yeah. So, and the fact that then right after this, the boys get into a fight, and then and the one guy throws the other son through the table. Mm-hmm. And then Mr. Greenleaf, it says that when Wesley gets up to go after Schofield, he bumps into Mrs. May, and it says, I'll try to find it, but it says, she would have fallen over if not for the knock at the door, which stood her back. Yeah, she would have collapsed, but a knock on the door stiffened her, meaning she would have fallen on the floor and been like, oh, you hurt me. But then there was a knock. She's like, oh, I gotta put on appearances again. I can't let somebody see from the outside that there's this fight going on. So it's like, she wasn't really going to get knocked over, but mm-hmm. she was going to get knocked over so she could play the victim. But now she has to put on her manners and put on her facade. And then Mr. Greenleaf is like, I heard a thump and I thought the plastering might've fell on you. She's like, no, nothing happened, but the table turned over. One of the legs was weak, you know?
Yep.
So she's just trying to keep that facade up.
Well, and I think it's interesting because even that facade, that Greenleaf genuinely is concerned for her well-being. Like, are you good? Like, I heard something happen, right? Mm-hmm. And her first thought is to, screw him over, to make him oh, and by the way, tomorrow you're gonna do that thing. I think about that scene in Huckleberry Finn where Huck and Jim get separated in the fog on their floating down the river, and then Huck decides to play a trick on Jim, making Jim believe the whole thing was a dream. It never really happened. And Jim kind of explains away each piece of his dream, and it's metaphorical. So he's like, oh, the dirt on the raft and the trees on the raft, and what does that represent, Jim? He's really just leading them on, just make him feel stupid. But Jim's no idiot. And he says at the end of it, he goes, what does this represent? I'll tell you what it represents. It represents trash. And trash is what it is when someone tries to put dirt on a friend's head and make them feel ashamed. Mm-hmm. When we were separated, I was almost broken, lost, thinking about, I didn't even care whether I lived or died anymore because I was worried that I had lost you. All you're thinking about is how you can make me feel bad. Shame on you, man. And boom, here we go. Because Mr. Greenleaf comes in, doesn't say anything. And is just trying to make sure that she's good. And she's like, son of a, she doesn't want to be seen as in any way vulnerable or beholden to this thing that's lower than her. And so it does, even at a certain point, it stings Mr. Greenleaf. It says that quick as a snake striking, he said, look, you've got two boys. Okay. You got two men on this place. So don't tell me that this is because of this, that, and the other, stop.
Yeah. They could take care of it.
But she says to him, again, some foreshadowing, some people learn gratitude too late, Mr. Greenleaf, and some never learn it at all. Here we go, man. So back,
dramatic irony.
Yeah, and back to Nightmare Time, right? So she has this dream again about this the sun trying to burn through the tree line, and she says, safe in the knowledge it couldn't burn through a tree line, had to sink all the way like it did outside of her property. When she first stopped, it was a swollen red ball, but then she stood watching it and began to narrow and pale until it looked like a bullet. We've used the word bullet in this podcast three, four, five, maybe seven times. Bullets aren't meant to stay in the chamber of a gun. The author is doing a really good job here of loading up that dramatic irony because it's about to blow up. So,
And then she woke up with her hand over her mouth and the same noise, diminished but distinct in her ear. It was the bull munching under her window. So the sound of the bullet racing towards her. Oh, again, it was just that bull munching again.
And a bull and bullet, right? That's not an accident.
That's interesting.
I'm interested too, because talking about, so now it's apocryphal, it's prophetic, it's getting bad. And I'm glad I brought a religion teacher on to help me talk about this. I am afraid, like a good Catholic, of reading the book of Revelation because I'm afraid it'll give me nightmares. Because there were some loaves, some fishes, there's a few shepherds and stuff, and the Bible is long and everyone knows everyone and it's long and boring. Fine. But then you get to the last book of the Bible. It's plot twist. There are dragons? Question mark.
Yep.
Book of Revelations is pretty dark and twisted. Is that, I mean, like,
it's got like seven heads and six horns, and the horn has two mouths. And,
accurate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, apparently there are signs that the end times are coming. Can you help me like kind of parse through some of that? Like, if I have any understanding of what Revelations is about, like these ideas of like signs and symbols that like doomsday is upon us or something.
Yeah. So the Book of Revelation it's a well-known genre of like ancient writing, apocalyptic writing. The Book of Daniel has some in it. There's a Jewish literature called the Book of Enoch. There are actually several books of Enoch where they use this just like highly symbolic language, and it's very much into numerology, and the animals all mean something, and very much wrapped up in terms of like the temple worship in Judaism. So like there's lampstands, and there's lamps and torches and books and seals, and everything symbolizes something. And so like the name, like the 666, the famous number of like the Antichrist, it referred to the Emperor Nero, who is a famous persecutor of Christians. And like his name, if you like translated the letters into numbers, it was 666. And so like all those things, it's kind of like a code almost in some way to describe the things that are happening, in their time. And it's just kind of a mystical, very poetic way of, kind of understanding and interpreting the events of, what was happening in the world of the early Christians. And there's lots of symbolism to the mass, and with, you know, the prayers being offered on the altar and the lamb being slain. And, so there's all sorts of symbolism. And it ends with, the marriage of heaven and earth and the new creation, the resurrection of the dead, and, the heavenly Jerusalem coming down to earth, and God dwelling with his people forever.
So everything you've just described is like nightmares already. Like, oh my God, I'm clearly not a good enough person. A, because I don't understand this stuff. B, because I have not read and deciphered it. And C, because I still got to get right with the get right. Like, if it happens tomorrow, I'm in trouble. I'm fascinated by the idea, though, that like all of these symbols, these like heavy, foreboding, ominous things about like this trial by fire at the end, like it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. As we see Mr. Greenleaf cleaning out the milk cans, he has seven cans, right? Like seven milk bowls, right? Like there's a symbol here, right? Like he had earlier six Greenleaf children who all spoke in one voice.
So seven is the it's the number of completeness, because like God created the world in 7 days, and like six is often the number of like imperfection, and of the devil. So because it's one less than seven,
right? You know? So here I go. I mean, like we have the seventh bowl being emptied here, or the seventh can being emptied, and then we have the seven Greenleaf kids all talking in one voice, and then Mr. Greenleaf chimes in. Now he's like the seventh Greenleaf voice, and when she gets in the car, she honks the horn, and she says she honked it like three long times and two or three short times. Like we're at six, here we go, tick tick tick, like the seventh trumpet sounding, the seventh bowl, the seventh seal, like it's all coming to this violent end times. This really cool symbolism, because the word violent actually comes up like four or five times in these last two pages here as we kind of crescendo to this inevitable conclusion, where heaven and earth are about to come together in a very real like painful kind of way.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting you see the Book of Revelation that way, because at the end of it, it says that they shall hunger no more, neither shall they thirst anymore. God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. So it's supposed to be, it ends in this great consolation. Yes, there's trial, and the idea is, again, it's not necessarily a prediction of the future about it as much as this is what you're going through right now. You're going through this trial and this tribulation now. But know that like God is coming with the new creation to complete it. And that's what you're waiting for. So it's like, it's the now times that are scary. God will eventually hold you in his hand and, in the bosom of Abraham. And
well, he'll hold you in his hand. He likes you. I don't know about me.
he knows you're a jerk on the outside, but nice on the inside.
I believe that God and Columbia University are conspiring against me. But that's a different story for another time. That's why I have a good therapist. Talking about the violence that's coming here and the end times, Mrs. May is inching precariously closer to the end here. Mm-hmm. She wants Mr. Greenleaf to be upset. She kind of gloats and smiles that she's making him march to the death of this bull, and almost like making him feel bad about it. She's delighted and like thinking about OT and OTET were probably splitting their sides, thinking that their dad would have to do, going to have to kill dad to shoot that bull. Like, so delighted to make dad be the bringer of death on this animal who's causing her so much trouble. And yet, when we look at this animal, it's in the field and it says it lifted its head indolently and then lowered it again and continued to eat. Like, I'm an English teacher, so I'm like, well, let me just make sure that this thing is, in fact, as violent as she's saying it is. And I Google the word indolently, and it's like basically in no particular hurry. It feels like this violent bull.
But it doesn't like cars, and she's honking.
And she all keeps the time. Honking again and again and again. So help me through the. You've earned the right to like do the big reveal here. We kept it in for like 90 minutes. I feel like you can.
All right. Yeah. So Mr. Greenleaf gets out to go shoot the bull, and he goes off into the woods, and she gets tired of waiting. So she like drives into the next pasture and gets out, and she's looking around, and then the bull comes and like runs across the field, and she, here, let's read it. It says, she decided to honk. She got up and reached inside the car window. She gave it three sustained honks. Here he is, Mr. Greenleaf. She called and looked on the other side of the pasture to see if he could be coming. She looked back, saw the bull, lowered his head, was racing towards her. She remained perfectly still, not in fright, but in freezing unbelief. She stared at the violent black streak bounding towards her as if she had no sense of distance. It's interesting because it says earlier on that she's nearsighted.
Yeah.
And so I think that's symbolic of not just physical sight. As if she just could not decide at once what his intention was, and the bull had buried his head in her lap like a wild, tormented lover before her expression changed. One of his horns sank until it pierced her heart, and the other curved around her side, held her in an unbreakable grip. Anyway, and then it says, and she had the look of a person whose sight had suddenly been restored, but who finds the light unbearable. And then Mr. Greenleaf shoots the bull through the eye four times, but not before she dies.
So
can I give you my big thought about the bull here?
Oh yeah, let's do it. I'm just fascinated by the idea of, again, like light and sight, and the idea that earlier it said that she didn't understand why she was so tired, but like through her closed eyes, she could feel the sun. Like, that's all happening at once here in the background. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, she's probably tired because she's been having nightmares the last 2 nights about bulls and bullets and stuff like that. So a bull in, you know, again, thinking biblically, is a sign of idolatry. The Canaanite god Baal, who the Israelites struggle to not worship throughout the history of the people of the Old Testament. Like that's who, when Moses goes up on the mountain to get the Ten Commandments, he's up there for 40 days, and the Hebrew people with Aaron are down below, and they get freaked out that he's gone for so long, and they fashion this golden bull and they worship it, and it's the Canaanite god Baal. And you know, the prophets throughout the Old Testament are struggling to get the people to not worship Baal and to worship Yahweh alone. And so a bull is very much associated with idolatry. And then there's two things here. One, there's a lot of like sexual romantic imagery between the bull. It keeps saying that he's like a lover, and like the one horn pierced her heart and the other one held her. Mm-hmm. It's like pierced her heart and curved around, and like it held her. So that was making me think of, I was like, there's a Greek myth about this where Zeus becomes a bull and like has his way with like a human, and it's Europa. So like Zeus comes down, this pagan god, and like has his way with a mortal woman. So it's like the bull has been pursuing her this whole time. But the other thing that makes me think of pagan gods and idolatry is, no offense to the pagans that are listening. So St. Thomas Aquinas, and I think he gets this from Augustine and from Plato too, is said that there's four substitutes that you can have for God, and they are wealth, pleasure, honor, like the respect of other people, and power.
Ooh, okay.
And yeah, so, and what is her idol?
Well, she wants to rule with an iron fist, right? So like,
yeah, she wants power. Control. Yeah. She wants to control everything. She wants to plan out every conversation. She wants to plan out every contingency with her will. It's like she has this idol of control that she wants to have power over everything. And then she's killed by this great symbol of idolatry. I don't think that's on accident from Flannery O'Connor.
I think you're really onto something there. And it really does tie in a bunch of different traditions, right? Like you'd mentioned, like the Greek and Roman tradition, but also the idea of the Christian faith, the idea of revelation, and the idea of like Old Testament about sacrificing and almost like something has to be slain so that the new world can come back the way it's supposed to.
Yeah.
And she said earlier, you know, I will die when I am good and ready. Like in this moment, she is maybe better than she has ever been. They mentioned that her eyes are like someone who's seeing the sun, even though she keeps her eyes closed. Like, here we go. There's your sign. God keeps knocking. God keeps knocking. God keeps knocking. And like to the point where if you're going to live your life and just be a miserable person and hate people, like, what is the purpose of continuing life? Like, it's a very real question here. And in that piercing of the heart, I think about that very Christian idea of like, you know, the Marian stuff. We're in the month of May. We can talk about like, you know, Mary's heart being pierced by a sword. But also like the story of Christ, like, you know, piercing his side or piercing his heart, where like from that ultimate act of vulnerability or ultimate act of surrender is how you have the chance for new life. And you mentioned that with the Revelation too, like, it is okay in the end, but you have to get through the rest of the book, which is the bad stuff, to get to the good stuff.
Yeah, well, and here's – so two things. One, what does Mrs. Greenleaf say when she's crying out to God? She says, sweet Jesus, stab me in the heart.
Yep.
and so – but she doesn't – but then Miss May doesn't let Jesus, like, access her emotions. It's this very detached – cerebral, whitewashed, tombed, hypocritical sort of Christianity where it doesn't sink in. And so anyway, the kind of my religion teacher interpretation of this is, if you don't let Jesus pierce your heart, whatever else you worship will pierce your heart.
Yeah.
And that will kill you.
Yeah.
Like, it, she didn't allow like Christ and like real love and real compassion to pierce her heart. And so her heart was instead pierced by this control, this anxiety, this, you know, fight to maintain status. And it's like, you, everybody worships something, you know, and if you don't worship God, if you don't worship the real God, you will find an idol to cling to. So that's kind of where I was going with this.
You know, I'll honor that, man. And I think of that line at the very, very end, she said about Mrs. Greenleaf, sort of throw one last line of shade on it. She says, you know, I'm afraid your wife let religion warp her. Like, and she believed that one was demented. In this, the radical non-belief of Mrs. May, again, is the idol she allows to consume her, right? This is what has warped her. Like, she's so not in for grace and mercy and kindness. And it's not like just to say that she's being kind and like to put on airs as if like she's pretending to be. Like, no, to be genuinely moved to compassion when people like Mr. Greenleaf showed up and was like, hey, are you okay? And your like next thought is, let me bury that guy. Let me make it harder for him.
Yeah. And so this is something that bothers me a little bit about this story is I was kind of kept, you mentioned like a moment of like a moment of clarity or a moment of grace for her. And I feel like she doesn't quite get it, that, you know, that moment from A Good Man Is Hard to Find where you said, you know, she would have been a good woman if she had somebody there to kill her whole life. I feel like Mrs. May never quite gets there.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, maybe at the end it says she had the look of a person whose sight had suddenly been restored, but who finds the light unbearable. It's almost like she finally sees everything at the end, but it's too late. It's like she doesn't get her moment of grace.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I, even at that last point, like three paragraphs from the end, they're talking about she was afraid that they were going to get a lawyer to sue her. Like, she's using anti-Semitic language there. Three lines prior, she's talking about like racial language and things like that. Like, up to the bitter end, she is bitter, and that is her end. And I think that for this person, they had an opportunity for grace much, much earlier. But from the moment she set foot on the Greenleaf's farm, she was never there to listen. She was being judged by the you know, the mute chorus of the kids who just looked at her and was like, okay, here we go. I wish this had a happy ending, but that's not how many stories go, I guess.
No.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast today. I hope you enjoyed.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Talking about nerd stuff and book stuff. Yeah,
absolutely.
Awesome. And if people,
this podcast is so necessary. Like, it's at like just at the nexus of like culture and religion, and I just I really like that you're doing it and you're the perfect person to do it. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Tell Columbia. are you on the internet where people can find you so that they can follow up with you after the podcast?
I am www.miketennymusic.com. And you can follow me on social media on Instagram and Twitter at PK Mikey T, PK MIKET. I think that's how it's spelled. Did I spell that right? M-I-K-E-Y-T. P-K-M-I-K-E-Y-T. And I'm on Facebook and in YouTube. But if you go to MikeTennyMusic.com, you'll find everything.
Awesome. 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 Well, Mike, thank you again for being on the podcast. I'm on Twitter too, at MeehanEDU. If you want to be a guest on the podcast, message me. Let's hang out. We still have like, I think she wrote 31 short stories and we've only covered about half of them. So I would love to have anybody who wants to talk. Pokey, would you come back on? Say yes.
Yeah, sure.
Perfect. Absolutely. Love that. Yeah. All right. So more later. In the meantime, if you can like, leave a comment, subscribe, say something nice about the podcast. It's an amazing way to get it in people's hands. We'll be back next week with another episode. God bless. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay apart, and we'll see you next time. Thanks again.